Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we have, I guess, all books to talk to the authors about.
Well, one of them is about a book, but it's also an event, which interestingly enough happened just not too long ago. So hang in there for the last segment. It's a really interesting one. But start, you know, starting up, who do we have, love?
Yeah, well, everybody's trying to figure out everything in the world of food has so exploded and taken over everybody's lives. Everybody's exploring and studying why and how all this happened. So the latest contribution to understanding why we eat what we do and who we are is Sophie Egan. And her book is a fascinating book called Devoured. Seems that everybody at this point in time is asking questions to define where we are in this food revolution. What do we mean by the culture of food in America? What is a so-called foodie, a term that's really not favored much by the food industry? And we have now a book from Sophie Egan called Devoured, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are.
It sounds like something that should be on HBO or Showtime coming right after Game of Thrones.
But Sophie asked some of these questions, and she is in a field with the Culinary Institute of America, West Coast campus, where she has to know about these things. And you've presented some thoughtful ideas on what all this food stuff means. I like your subtitle, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies. So tell us, what are some of the things that you've discovered about what we eat, how Americans eat?
Certainly, and thank you so much for having me. So in the course of my research, I discovered that not only is food a really powerful mirror for who we are, but in the United States, most of our food choices can really be traced back to our three core values we have as Americans. And the patterns that I found were that they're work, freedom, and progress are these deeply ingrained elements of our collective mindset that affect our daily relationships to food. So I'll give you some examples. In the U.S., we have a premium on individualism, and that leads us to want to personalize and customize our eating. We also eat alone more than we ever did before. Much of that comes from this way of viewing ourselves as independent as opposed to interdependent, which is much, much more the way that other food cultures or other cultures consider themselves in relationship to their neighbors and their communities.
Now, you have some startling statistics, actually, in this book, that like 40% of North American workers eat lunch at their desks. That's really startling, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And yes, that's, as I mentioned, work is one of the other core values that really affects our eating in stunning ways. And so in addition to eating at our desks, this phenomenon that's been called sad desk lunch, people are sitting at their computers and they're, you know, spewing crumbs all over the keyboard, and they're sort of paying attention to what they're eating and sort of paying attention to the screen. It's a very mindless way of eating. There's sort of this death of the lunch break as a cultural norm. We're working more than we ever did before, about 200 more hours per year compared with about a generation ago.
Which means we're snacking more than we're eating and more than we're dining, right?
Well, snacking definitely comes with it, because many people feel that instead of designing their daily routines around mealtimes, they are squeezing in food where they have, you know, just a breath of fresh air amidst an endless sort of hectic flow of meetings and calls and to-do items and activities. So because things are busier than they've ever been, and much of that busyness is increasing amounts of time spent working, we are snacking much more than before. But it's also because of how much we've normalized snacking. So because there are other people around us are doing it, so they're having the beef jerky in their purses or carrying around, you know, protein bars or snap pea crisps or every kind of chip imaginable. Maybe they're eating on the sidelines of their kid's soccer game or you name it, eating in meetings and all kinds of things. All the lines have really been blurred. My research suggests that this is happening on top of what you might eat anyway. So we're actually eating more total calories than we used to.
Now, that's, of course, if you're one of the lucky ones and nobody stole your lunch.
Yeah, that was
I thought that was
fridge theft.
I thought that was really horrifying. How did you obtain the statistics that led you to the sad conclusion that 40% of people were having their lunch purloined?
No, 40% refers to how many people are eating lunch at their desk.
Oh, yeah. I see.
I
okay.
don't think it's quite that number. I hope
but
for
you,
that
you know,
quite
I've been,
that rampant.
I can't remember where I was, but I worked someplace where actually people stole lunches from the refrigerators. It became an issue.
Oh, it is.
Yes, that's what he's referring to. I definitely include that in the book. I don't know that I have a percentage of victims of fridge theft, but certainly this does happen. And there's all kinds of peculiarities of office kitchens. Some people kind of load up for the week and essentially occupy several shelves with their whole groceries worth, you know, for the week, because we've essentially moved into the workplace. Many people eat not only lunch, but breakfast, and some people even eat dinner at the workplace.
Well, it used to be the car.
Well, you also had the intriguing story of the donuts. People bring donuts and treats like that, not only so that their colleagues can share them, but so that they can have a guilty visit themselves.
Exactly. Yes, I always thought that was a funny trait. I don't know if this has happened in offices you've worked in, but I've certainly seen this where it's, you know, oh, I brought this for the office. Sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've worked in places where they've actually been assigned. You know, it's your turn to bring the donuts, you know.
Oh, yeah. Funny.
I love the one about the lady brought the donuts, and then she ate half of one, and then she went back to the box, and she ate another fraction, and then she ate another fraction, and she finished up eating more than a whole donut when she'd originally intended only to eat half a donut.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed that. I think that we all recognize a little bit of ourselves in that, right? I call that this denial dicing, where you're sort of torturing yourself with, oh, I would never dare eat an entire, you could replace any number of things if it weren't a donut that's your particular item, but, you know, if it's a cookie or a brownie or a scone or whatever it is that's tempting you or taunting you, you know, you sort of poke and prod at it. Well, you can't get it out of your mind.
You know, one of the things I would say that a lot of the traits that you delineate in your book are specifically American, but there are some other traits that are actually spread throughout the world, because we do a lot of traveling and attending conferences and so forth all over the world. And an article I read actually today said that one of the reasons we have this food culture and the so-called foodie culture is it's social currency. And if you think about it, this is true of people in Spain. It's true of the Japanese. The more you know about the food world, the culinary world, the better social standing you get.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I definitely agree with that. And I also agree that there are many traits in the book that I described that characterize American eating habits, but they are not necessarily limited to Americans. But a big part of that also, though, is the fact that we export so much of our food culture through, you know, fast food chains, through different packaged products, through even sort of, you know, holiday-type experiences that get shared all around the world. So some of those certainly are coming from the countries themselves, and some of them we've sort of left our imprint on.
Now, there are two chapters further on in the book that worry me a little bit, and I want to mention them, and I have you chat just a little bit about them if you'd like. But I wondered then if you can, because I didn't get all the way to the end of the book, if you concluded that this trend that I'm going to talk about is going to continue, or if we, and we sure hope not, that in fact it's going to stop. And I put both of these things under what I call overindulgence, which is a particular American eating habit that's really very unattractive.
I see Peter thinks of his youth growing up in England, and he's very loath to admit that, in fact, it is not the same in England now. There are just as many fat people
Okay, that's not necessarily what I'm talking about here. But what I mean by overindulgence is the first chapter is the one about the introduction of new products by purveyors of foodstuffs. New things that will excite and titillate the palate so that people will eat more. So if you like, it's the side of overindulgence that says it's encouraged by producers of food. And then the other is the just blatant amount of snacking and noshing that goes on during one particular event in the year, the football Super Bowl.
Oh, the Super Bowl.
Where you have some statistics that are just so incredibly frightening. It's not surprising that you see so many fat people in the street. Surprising, I guess, that you see any of the normal weight at all when you encounter the amount of food that passes people's lips on one day in February. Talk to us about those two things just a little bit.
Sure. So the new products. So this is really fascinating to me. Just flood of not only marketing, but actual new items in a given grocery store as well as in the marketplace in terms of restaurant and fast food chains. So there are already about 42,000 items in the average American grocery store, which is completely staggering. And each year there are thousands of new products added. And what concerns me is less actually on the indulgence side, but on prevalence of health claims.
Oh, yes.
And the percentage of new products that have some kind of claim about their health or nutritional attributes has been on the rise since about 2002. And this definitely gets us to buy more of them because of this health halo aspect that I described, where if you see something like made with whole grain or gluten-free or fat-free or non-GMO or you name it, you actually think that that product on the whole must be healthier, so you eat more of it than you would have. And in reality, a lot of those claims are very misleading.
You know, they just caught today, I read on the Internet, they just brought suit against Cheez-Its because it was advertising whole grain and it made you think that it was healthier, but it's pretty much the same as the original Cheez-Its. It's
Not nearly enough regulation of the term specifically with regard to whole grain. You know, you can say made with whole grain and it can be over 50% not whole grain, and there's a whole bunch of issues with that. But in general, so just this flood of products, but I think what you're referring to originally with the new ones is what I call stunt foods. And these are much more concerning than anything else. These are like Doritos Locos Tacos from Bell.
You know what?
We've never had one of those.
I had never even heard of one of those.
Yes, this,
I must not have been paying attention, huh?
This product, which is neon orange taco, where the shell is made out of Doritos, this is actually one of the best-selling fast food items in American history. We collectively, as Americans, purchased 100 million of them in 10 weeks and sustained an average of 1 million DLTs, as they're called, per day for the first year. Just a completely stunning number that we have consumed, and many more products like it have come out of the R&D labs of various fast food chains. We've seen waffle tacos, there's bacon sundaes, there's pizzas wreathed in hamburgers and hot dogs, bacon wrapped pizza. I mean, you name it, there's just a complete flood of new products, and often they're pitched with the very powerful marketing tactic of false scarcity, which is this limited time only, hurry in now. And it gets us really to sort of hoard or feel like we have to load up. And it plays to a very American appreciation of novelty and sort of innovation, but also this sense of going back to work that we really have a lot of our self-worth wrapped up in productivity. What do we have to show for our time? And that relates to something I describe as the experiential resume, where it's like a bucket list that you want to click off things that collect experiences. And actually Taco Bell, when they came out with that Doritos Locos Taco, they must have known how powerful this urge is, because they had the tagline, Live Mas. You know, this idea that by buying a Doritos Locos Taco, you are living a full life. And, you know, that's how you can sort of feel that you are, collecting a really worthwhile food experience. So there's just a tremendous number of these things. And what's bizarre about them is they're so over the top with their shocking level of indulgence, you know, like more sugar than, you know, five Snicker bars in one thing, one serving, or as I mentioned, you know, 3 feet of bacon wrapped around a pizza. Completely, you know, unabashedly celebrating their
it sells. I mean, like this whole gluten-free thing, it's been the fastest growing, I don't know, as a multi-billion dollar industry, gluten-free. And I mean, it just gets tossed around. Let's jump ahead.
Well, the lucky thing you see is DLTs are gluten free because they're made with corn, not wheat.
Yeah.
nobody thought of claiming that, I guess.
Tell me this. Let's jump forward. I mean, you give us all this data, and mm-hmm. And you've really researched a lot of statistics and your conclusions. You have that final chapter on, you know, what does this mean? And, mm-hmm. and do you predict anything? Do you propose anything to remedy it or what?
Yeah, so this book was never meant to be a manifesto or lay out a policy agenda. But I do have some things a sort of calls to action, if you will. And I describe it in that chapter of what to make of all of this. In essence, I really encourage people to take more control over the preparation of their food. So I am time starved myself, but I think that if all of us start to carve out more time where we can, maybe it's on weekends, for cooking, that is a very important step toward claiming more control over the kind of food system that we want to have and over what we're putting in our bodies. I also am calling for, just in general, an appreciation of real whole foods. So much of what we are surrounded by is processed foods, and you know, about 60% of our calories and 90% of our added sugar come from ultra processed foods, and that's a real problem. So, as armed with the knowledge that I, or the self awareness that I hope Devoured can provide readers with, we can start to gain this bird's eye perspective on ourselves. And really start to call out some of these marketing tactics for what they are. And I hope develop relationships with food that appreciate some of those natural whole foods, as opposed to just looking for the latest new over-the-top thing coming out of an R&D lab.
Well, Michael Pollan did it very simply. Eat real food, not too much, mainly plants.
Yes, and at the end of my night,
I am
inspired by his. Right.
And what are your 10 words?
Yes, yeah, so I'm inspired by that is work less and savor more.
Yep.
Make it real and stir the pot. And the last part, stir the pot, is about things that I think we need to do differently as a food culture. Clearly we have some issues, but there's also a lot to celebrate, and I don't want that to be missed. Talk about the pot, I'm talking about our melting pot cuisine and what a privilege it is in the United States to have access to such a variety of global cuisines, and how interesting it makes it to be an eater with all the different culinary collisions that result, that sort of bubble up from that collective melting pot to really define what American fare is.
Right.
Well, that's such a thoughtful way to conclude our conversation. I suspect that Devoured Too is there somewhere. I'm sure you're going to realize there are some things you left out, and we'll look forward to the next installment, because it really is a quite fascinating book, very well written and filled with very interesting observations. many of them with a wry feeling about them.
Yes.
As in W-R-Y, which we in particular enjoy. So
thank you so much.
Yeah, we congratulate you on a job well done, and I hope our paths will cross in person one of these days.
Likewise, and thank you so much. I would love to continue the conversations, and let me know if you're ever at the castle.
Right. Thank you, Sophie.
All right, thank you. Take care.
Bye.
And it's time for us to take a break, but don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, if we got a look at the food scene through the eyes of a nutritionist, which is Sophie Egan, we're now going to take a look at the flavors we've lost from the point of view of somebody who's not only a distinguished food writer, but also a Paris-trained chef.
So if you've heard of the phrase back in the day,
yes.
I guess this is back in the day revisited. With what's relevant, considering the point of view of the author,
Patrick Q,
who's certainly very qualified to opine on the subject. I'm sure you'll find his conversation very interesting.
Patrick Q really knows what he's talking about. Not only is he a really well-known and appreciated restaurant critic for Los Angeles Magazine, but he also is a chef, he is chef trained, so he knows, what I always say is, from both sides of the table, I always say the same thing because I once owned a restaurant. You can approach it from both sides of the table. But anyhow, this is all good background for you writing this book that we're going to talk about, which is called Finding the Flavors We Lost, subtitled From Bread to Bourbon, How Artisans Reclaimed American Food. As I said when we were talking briefly, reading this book, I sensed that you've been pondering this and pondering and thinking about writing it for a long time.
And you were right, Anne. I suppose about 10 years ago, I started seeing the word artisanal all over menus, and I had to figure out, was it a trend like fusion cuisine or something, or what were its merits? And certainly, I saw some funny things like artisan Doritos.
Oh, that was funny! Oh, I love that artisan Doritos.
Yes, so that made me question whether I really wanted to write this book. But ultimately, the quality of the food I was seeing, even in cultured butter that would come out, that a chef would send out with a few little naturally leavened rolls, you say, wow, if the bread and the butter is of this quality, this is really transforming the way we're looking at food. So
now, Patrick, did you ever think about how we got in this mess in the first place from which artisanal has rescued us? I mean, what was the reason? Was it because we wanted our food to be cheap and we didn't care what it tasted like?
Well, that certainly could have been one of the reasons. There were many strands to lead to the kind of homogenization of the way we eat. One was the speed of transportation. The railroads in the late 19th century had already divided the country into time zones. Once upon a time, transportation was by river, down the Ohio River, down the Mississippi River, kind of a north-south axis. But railroads sort of opened up the country. There was an east-west way of transportation. Methods of food preservation had developed very quickly. Pasteurization certainly played a role. Then frozen foods. Bottom line, by 1950, there was a lot of food out there that nobody had any idea where it came from. It was transported in the dead of night. It had no more connections to place. It had no more connections to tradition. You know, the great American table had been reduced to five-can casserole and a bunch of back-to-the-landers, you know, hippies, said, we don't want it.
That's the first, your first chapter talks about some of those characters in the 70s, right?
Exactly. And, you know, that was long before the internet. That was the era of the self-addressed stamped envelope when you sent away for knowledge. if you wanted to learn how to pickle or if you wanted to learn how to make cheese, you know, somebody else had figured out just enough that they could give you instruction. And so a few weeks later, you'd get the package or the letter, you know, here's how you make feta cheese. And, of course, the curious thing with food is once you realize, my goodness, I can make something, it's sort of addictive. You say, well, I want to make it better. And you mentioned what ingredient was it. One could make an argument it was bread with something like the Tassajara bread book of 1970.
Oh, right. I remember that.
Yeah. Or one could make an argument that it was beer. And Home Brew Club said beer can be better than the mass-produced stuff that is, you know, unfortunately what American beer has come to. And let's figure out how to make beer. And both bread and beer play large parts in my book.
Well, you have also personalities involved with this, like in terms of Beer Nancy Silverton.
Yes, yes. Early on in the research process, I realized, you know, I want to tell this through the artisan's eyes. I don't want it to be the distant narrator sort of expounding on something. These are stories of people's quests to become artisans. And full of difficulty, full of challenge. You know, there was no guild that could train them. There was very little tradition left when they started out. So, for instance, bread, yes, I put it through Nancy Silverton's sort of experience trying to do naturally leavened fermented breads here in Los Angeles in the late 80s. And just the struggles, you know. Natural leavening is like a baby. You know, is it the dough? You don't have the safety of a packet of yeast. You know,
yeah.
you have to feed it a certain amount of flour. Yes.
So and then the cheese. I mean, that's a story in itself. How the cheese, artisanal cheese. This country developed, and you know, it's now on a par with all the international cheeses.
That's right. Well, we had a great cheese making tradition here, and of course, certain states are known for that, like Wisconsin, Vermont. But it's done on a larger scale, and so. What I tried to concentrate on was sort of the back to the land folks who, in late 60s or mid 70s, were saying, "Well, we bought a cow to help restore the land, and the cow is producing all this milk, and what do you do with milk?" So they started making cheese, and you know on. It's a simple process. You acidify the milk. You introduce a culture. You add rennet. You separate the curds and the whey. But that doesn't mean you're going to get anything that somebody wants to eat. So you will get a block of something that appears to be cheese. So I think the tricky thing is how do you become an artisan? How do you become driven by quality? How do you want to make something fantastic? And so that's really the artisanal motivation, excellence. How do I make it better?
Now, what is it? Is it that you come across someone who's a real expert artisan in their own right already, and they show you. I mean, it seems like that's what happened to the guys from Rogue Creamery in Oregon. I mean, they bought the business from the guy who was going out of business, but who had smuggled Roquefort culture into this country.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Apparently he smuggled some in. That's how he got there.
And, illegally, obviously.
And then, okay. And then you have the sisters from Point Reyes Cheese in California who were sort of fiddling around with making cheese, and then I think did the father pass away or something?
She found herself a single mother of how many lots of kids.
Well, they had a family, so they had a family meeting, and they said, "Well, what are we going to do?" Oh no, I remember what it was. He made whole milk, but he was getting too old to deal with the daily grind of supplying whole milk. So they said, "Well, what are we going to do?" So they had a family meeting, and they decided that what they could do, instead of being in the whole milk business, they could make cheese. And it's taken them about 8 to 10 years to really get to where they have a superb product, and a superb product that's able to support several families at the same time.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you how you organize this book, because I was just about to bring up Zingerman's, because it's close to my heart. I went to school in Ann Arbor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so I know the scene, you know.
Good.
But that chapter is called To Market. So,
yes.
So you're not dealing with the pioneer hippies now. Tell me your organization.
Yes, well, that's an interesting question. You know, of course, as you know, from a writer's point of view, organization is half the battle. How am I going to lay this out?
Exactly.
And from the beginning, I knew I didn't want it to be just chapters on different ingredients. I didn't want the to be just the beer chapter, the bread chapter, the bacon chapter. I wanted to talk about those subjects and maybe make them the center of chapters, but I wanted for the narrative to continue to flow, a bigger narrative. And so as an organizing principle, I chose verbs that I could sort of organize a chapter under, because there are so many aspects of what is the artisanal revolution. And part of the artisanal revolution is transforming the way people bought ingredients. And the notion of the sort of the modern country store that would introduce you to new ingredients. So the Zingerman's chapter, and Zingerman's, of course, is the legendary deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan, that chapter is called To Market. And you know, here's a bunch of college students, or they just graduated from Michigan.
Yeah, Ari, I think, was a philosophy major.
I think he was Ari Weinzweig, yeah, the philosophy major, and Russian literature, or Russian history, and the anarchist movement.
Yeah.
So they were all working in this kind of fancy, ambitious restaurant in Ann Arbor called Maud's, early 80s, late 70s bistro. And it was one of those sort of artisan moments. There's quality out there. There's quality in American goods, in Newski's bacon, and Cy Ginsburg corned beef from Detroit. You know, it doesn't have to be French and Italian. We've got great stuff here. And they started this deli in downtown Ann Arbor, just selling it and selling sandwiches. And
they were good too.
And yes, the quality won people over. And you know, there's that idea of, well, it costs a dollar more than the other place. But so they had to engage with what's an important question is, okay, sometimes artisanal food does cost a little bit more, but this is what you're getting for that extra dollar. You know, you're getting local stuff. You're getting you're providing jobs in a local economy. You're getting a higher quality. You're getting a reestablished tradition. And, of course, you're getting fantastic flavor. So that's why I call that chapter To Market.
Right. You know, it's not in this chapter, but I thought one of your most convincing narratives or characterizations was here you have Jean-Louis Paladin, who's French. It was so French, wasn't he?
Completely. Yeah. From Gascony. Yeah,
from Gascony. And he comes to the States, and he slowly discovers all the American products. We know the Jamison Farms people who produced lamb for him, organic.
Oh, yes,
they tell the story. They're writing a book right now, and he plays a large part in it, about how when they carried three baby lambs into the restaurant on his orders, and when he looked at them, he started to cry with happiness.
Oh.
So he was serious about it.
No, he didn't. He didn't start to cry because he was worried the lambs were dead.
It was just, you know, they were just so beautiful. It's the lamb.
Well, that's an interesting. Yes, I think that was a key step. Jean-Louis Paladin, whose restaurant Jean-Louis at the Watergate opened in Washington, D.C. in 1978, because he had two Michelin stars, which was in France. Which was very, very high. There's about 20 restaurants that have three Michelin stars. And he came to the United States, and traditionally, that would have demanded him to get flown in Dover sole and flown in truffles. And essentially, nothing in the United States would have been good enough, and everything would have to have been imported. And Jean-Louis was original enough, and he said, well, that's sort of crazy. Here I am tasting incredible corn in Virginia. Here I am eating, you know, incredible soft-shell crab in Maryland. Here I am tasting fantastic hams as good as anything from Gascony. Why would I be importing everything when these ingredients exist here? So Jean-Louis sort of based his cooking on American ingredients with the most refined French technique, which made him a legendary chef.
Now, is there another example of someone like this who's sort of one of your heroes?
Well, now, of course, the locavore movement is taking it beyond anything that Jean-Louis took it, which has become very, very local. And, of course, in today's restaurants, they want you to know that nothing has come further than a certain distance.
Oh, I get so tired of the wording. It's the words that drive me nuts. It's farm to table, and now it's farm to fork, and it's, you know.
Yes.
And then there are the people who limit. They do this in London, too, or in England. They limit the area of sourcing to like 100 miles.
We went to that one restaurant which we were really enjoying, and it was a 25-mile radius, and then and noticed that the chef's fingernails were very dirty. So all of a sudden,
I forgot about that.
All of a sudden, it fell off its pyramid.
Well, 25 miles in England in winter doesn't get you much more than a turnip.
I know.
But I'm glad that they're making it work. You know, sometimes words and terms are there to represent sort of a certain idealism, is how I interpret it. And I always think of that when I hear the term natural wine. There's a natural wine. So that makes me immediately, I think, well, what's an unnatural wine? You know, there's no such thing. But what they're sort of using a term to describe a wine that is maybe fermented with its own natural yeasts and has not been handled too much and is kind of fresh, and when they're good, they're absolutely fantastic. So I feel that these days we have to make a few leeway, you know, a few allowances, I guess, for terms that catch on and not be too literal about them, because often they're just there to represent sort of a certain idealism.
Now, but
there are dangers here. Let me give you one danger. One of the world's best wine academies. Is the University of California at Davis,
right in
which I'm sure you're right about. But
yeah.
the difficulty here, I think, is that a lot of people now making wine in a way that you describe, in a natural way, are saying that people who are graduating from Cal Davis are chemists. They're not winemakers. They can make the grapes produce a wine that tastes like anything they want to. And there's something seriously wrong with that idea.
Well, I mean, talking about wine, the great authority of Davis, Maynard Amorin, used to say wine is biochemistry. So if you don't understand certain, you know, terms or you're going to make spoiled wines. There is a big dialogue going on in the wine world, and both sides have important points to make. Davis, unfortunately, at times gets sort of becomes the whipping with the,
right.
You know, the whatever the term is for all sorts of other beliefs. I mean, the truth of the matter is Davis has created more fine winemakers than any other institution.
That's also true. Yes, there's no question about
that. But can they do things differently? Probably. Nobody's perfect.
Well, you know, I mean, there's so many things we could talk to you about, and we have one of the things we've learned in our 13 years of broadcast is that listeners have a finite attention span.
So, yeah.
But I do want, since the purpose of this book is exploring what do we mean when we say artisanal. Could you give us a brief rundown on, you say it does not have to do with size, for example.
Well, artisanal to me, it is an overused term, but at its best, it means you don't pencil out the requirement of time when you're making something. I mean, uh-huh. a great bread may take 24 hours fermenting. A great bourbon may be in cask for 7 years. You can produce bread in 35 minutes from flour to package. You can make a neutral spirit and flavor it in less than 2 hours. So if you're not ready to commit to the time that flavor requires, you're not an artisan, whatever the label says.
Interesting.
Secondly, if there's no connection to tradition, I think the whole artisanal premise is a reconnection with tradition and with the idea that the human hand plays a role in creating foods and drinks. A bubblegum vodka is never going to be an artisanal bubblegum vodka because it's not connecting to any tradition that existed before it.
Well, let me try this with you as we close up, Patrick. How about a definition that says it's artisanal if you can't buy it at Walmart?
Well, Peter, I'd almost agree with you, but artisanal is growing, and I think the next challenge is how can artisanal foods grow and maintain their integrity? And one day they will be sold at Walmart, and it will be real artisanal food.
Yeah, that's your prediction for the food of the future, is it's going to be growing. It's not going to be on this small scale, isolated.
No.
Yeah, okay, so that is what you determined to be the future of food, huh?
You know, I think when artisans can provide jobs, can provide health benefits, can provide careers in an economy that provides fewer and fewer of those things for young people, it's a fantastic development. And as long as they can maintain their artisanal quality, I think it's great.
Well, this is a great book, Patrick. It's there are many, many questions in it that you have to ponder. So
kind
it gets
of you
you
to
thinking,
say.
Yeah. And it's so readable. I mean, of course, you're such a beautiful writer that it's something you want to keep pushing ahead and keep reading all
Thank
the way
you.
Through it. And I wish you much success with it.
And, Thank you very much.
Yeah, and really enjoyed talking to you. Patrick.
Likewise.
Again,
thank you so much.
Yeah, it's Finding the Flavors We Lost, and it's by Patrick Q.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Before we include the final track in today's program, we have a guilty little secret to reveal. Miss Anne, who is in many respects an extraordinarily sophisticated person and obviously a great food and wine person, nevertheless has an ugly fascination with the mass consumption of food, and especially the contest held on the 4th of July each year in Coney Island, New York, called it's named after the establishment which created it, Famous Nathan's, yeah. Beg your pardon. I don't know what it's actually called.
These are competitive extreme eaters.
And of course.
And there's a hot dog eating contest.
And it just happened recently.
And you have to eat the buns as well.
Yeah, and it happened just recently. In fact, the previous winner who had practically made it his own race and had a dispute with the organizers of it as a result, emerged as a new champion once again.
And then somebody else took over. Now Joey Chestnut won this year's 4th of July.
He came back.
What's more American than the 4th of July? What's more American than Nathan's Hot Dogs at Coney Island?
And Joey Chestnut consumed 70 of them.
In 10 minutes.
On primetime TV, no less. So here's the story of how that and all the other things around this fabulous New York City establishment got itself going and what happened to it.
Lloyd Handworker probably had not a clue when I contacted him that I am a great fan of the famous Nathan's hot dog eating contest on the 4th of July. And he and I were just chatting about all the drama involved. But Lloyd, what we're talking about, you are actually the grandson of an American icon, Nathan Handworker. And you give the story, which in fact is, as you subtitle your book, Famous Nathan. It is family saga, a historical saga, the American dream, personified or made concrete, and the search for the perfect hot dog. All of that woven into this book. Now, I hope you don't mind my saying so that, but you can tell from how you selected all these details and how you present your story that you're used to being able to create a whole reality on a film or a video.
Yes, I worked on it for 30 years. That's the part that maybe some people don't know. I started it after my grandfather was no longer alive. I mean, I had an interest when he was alive. He used to be a really great storyteller, and I did record some things when I was about 10 years old. But
yeah, you said you were 10 years old, and you had the ability to record it, and then your grandmother called him away, and you never got to finish the conversation.
That's true. She was always protective of him, you know, making sure he got his meals in, took naps. I don't know, maybe she was tired of him telling the stories so many times. I'm not quite sure, but, you know, yeah, I still remember that interview. I still remember the things he told me, but it wasn't a complete interview, that's for sure. And unfortunately, he died when I was only 17, and there are a lot of things that were lost to me. So I started interviewing relatives, people that were alive who knew him, who had worked for him or knew him personally. I hunted down workers,
business associates, anyone I could find over quite a number of years, to know one more thing about my family, to know about my grandparents, to know what it was like in this business, why he was successful. So I was quite interested in that and kept pursuing it for many years. And I was a photographer and then went to film school. So, you know, I ended up making a film and then writing this book a little bit after that.
So you did a film documentary, didn't you?
Yes, I did a documentary called Famous Nathan that premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival 2 years ago and then started working on the book immediately after.
It's just such an amazing story. Can you just briefly describe the situation that your grandfather escaped from and how he came here with nothing and built
sure.
his fortune?
Yeah, I mean, he grew up in a small town. He was born in Noral in Poland. He was one of 13 children. My great-grandfather was a shoemaker, a very poor shoemaker, didn't make a lot of money. My grandfather knew what it was like to go hungry on various nights and days in his childhood. At three, he had some Hebrew lessons, but by six, he was already apprenticing as a shoemaker to his father. Never got a chance to go to any formal schooling. Actually, the parents had a choice because he grew up in a small town whether to send them to school. So my grandfather was essentially illiterate even after being in America for many years. He didn't know how to read or write.
Yeah, I don't know how you do that. I mean, he came here with some, how much money did he have in his shoe?
He had $25 in his shoe. I mean, that's what he thought he needed to, you know, get into the country. He worked very hard from an early age. At 11, he was working in a bakery far from his home. He didn't see his parents or his family for 2 years. He was working
nice.
Pretty much day and night at this bakery, helping to bake bread and then selling it.
For like a quarter or something.
Yeah, I mean, and he took all the money that he made during those 2 years when he and he decided to go home. He spent it all on meat at a butcher shop for his family. So he already had that sense of helping the family and a sense of charity, and he wasn't motivated by money, let's say. He cared about his customers, he cared about his workers, he just wanted to do good in the world and be charitable and succeed, but he had an incredible work ethic. No limits to the amount of hours that he would put into work, you know, so. That's a big part of his success.
Now, Lloyd, would you say that he invented the modern hot dog? I mean, tube steaks, I guess, have been around for a long time, but he did something different.
He didn't actually invent it. I mean, Feltman. There was a guy named Charles Feltman who's
okay.
credited with inventing that in 1867 in Coney Island, and my grandfather actually works for Charles Feltman's son. That was a very famous place down there. And supposedly was the first one to put the sausage in a bun. But he certainly popularized it and became the biggest seller of it within a short amount of time after taking over. But, you know, that's because he started, you know, originally he was selling it for 10 cents, which everyone else was, and he made 60 bucks on the weekend that he was working, and it wasn't going to be enough to cover his rent because he was only working weekends. So, you know, he was working on the weekends and working another job in the city. He only made $60, so he decided, I'm going to cut it to a nickel, and was concerned that, you know, that he might be stepping on some people's toes. They might be upset at him undercutting them. But he pursued it, and he made $260 on the following weekend. So he was set. He decided he was going to work 7 days a week in Coney Island. He was going to give up his other job. And the rest is history. I mean, it wasn't like it was easy, but after a number of years, he was, you know, he had a high-quality product. He was always fanatical about quality, and people started coming there. And, you know, he slowly grew the business. The depression was actually when he doubled the business because he had a product that was inexpensive enough for families to afford.
Do you have any of this? Did you inherit any of this business acumen?
It's a good question. Well, I think I've inherited some of the stamina, you know, of the film industry. That's where I work. It requires very long hours, 16-hour days sometimes 6 days a week. But, and I'm good with math, which I know he was very good at, but never had my chance to work in a business like that. So, not sure, but I think I have a kind of common sense. I mean, I think that's kind of the secret to his success. He really was kind of just intuitive about the choices he made and the way that he promoted the business and the way that he took care of the customers. He kept the hot dog 5 cents for 30 years and many of the other products. So, I mean, it's something people don't realize. I mean, he really kept prices low.
I don't know how you do that, actually.
I guess
you know how.
Well, he did. I mean, you know, he was...
You lose money on every hot dog and make it up on volume.
Yeah, it was about volume. Absolutely. He just... And he got the crowds that way. That's where, you know, people are going to have drinks and they're going to have seafood. Eventually, seafood came in much later, but he got the volume.
It does sound like an American dream story and a true heroic... Well, I mean, he made the transition from impoverished, besieged Europe, ghetto environment to the New World and succeeded. But not everything ran that smoothly. I mean, he found the perfect woman for him, and I think that story's kind of cute, too.
Yes.
Why did he marry her?
He married her because she was a good worker.
Yeah.
She was fast. He hired her. She was actually friends with his sister,
uh-huh.
Right? And he hired her away from his sister. They were working. My grandmother and my great aunt were working at a little stand, and they weren't doing much business. So he paid her more and came to work for him. And she was fast. She was like, yeah, she was a perfect double for my grandfather. The same work ethic, tough, unlimited hours. My grandmother spent so many hours and years and decades in the kitchen, sitting, peeling potatoes, chopping potatoes, peeling onions. I mean, in those days, they didn't have, you know, electronic machinery. That came later. So, I mean, she was a perfect partner, and he included her in many business decisions. Took her to business meetings. I mean, you know, they were really a close couple.
But did he marry just to stop her paying her wages, or...?
I think, no, he was in love with her. He said he had a dream that he was going to marry her.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You know, and he pursued
it. It was very romantic, yes.
Now, the business itself had some adventures over the years, right?
Yeah, well, he had two sons and a daughter. The sons, of course, he wanted all his family to be in the business. The sons came back from World War II. They were both overseas. You know, they had some ambitions of their own. They wanted to try new things. My grandfather was very cautious about changes. He had found a formula that was quite successful. And I think he was very tough on his kids. He wasn't a person that praised people. You know, I think that was the way he grew up. So I think it was kind of tough being, you know, a son to him. But they came up with some ideas that he resisted, eventually agreed to, and some of them were good. I mean, like, my uncle came up with the seafood counter, and that's seems like a no-brainer in Coney Island, but my grandfather was afraid that people who were kosher would not come to Nathan's anymore.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And then my father had brought in the deli contestant, you know. So, you know, my grandfather thought these were complicated, and maybe he liked the simplicity of the menu that he had, but he eventually allowed them to do some things like that. But, you know, the two of them had different ideas, and there were some conflicts between my father and my uncle over personnel and over business decisions, and they both wanted to expand, which was something my grandfather also resisted. They thought, we have this great model, this great name, why don't we take it to Long Island? Why don't we take it to the city? And my grandfather was, you know, very opposed to that for lots of reasons, and, you know, which led to both of the brothers leaving the business at one time or another to start their own businesses. So it's a complicated tale of expansion, and the expansion and the going public of the company became, you know, it didn't work so well, actually. You know, there are a lot of problems with expansion. It's hard to find the right management, the right locations. There are many mistakes made in that pursuit after, you know, and even after my grandfather had passed away.
Yeah, there are many stories like that. One of them that sticks in my mind was the conflict in the Mondavi family in California between Robert and his brother, and they, which concluded with them having a fight, and one of them stormed off and started his own business.
Right. It's not uncommon in family businesses. I mean, you know, families are complex, and then you add a business to it and working full time under that kind of stress, tempers, you know, can flare, and it happened with my grandfather's brother. I mean, they got into a fight over how to make lemonade, and my grandfather fired his brother. That was the early days.
That was early.
You know, later it was, you know, between my dad and my uncle over how to share power and all that, and that was difficult for my grandparents to handle and know what to do with. So I think, you know, family businesses are
they're
often
tricky.
Complex.
But yeah. But you decided to record it all, and how grateful people who don't remember that era, because they never talked to anybody who lived then, must be to be able to read it here in the way that you've put it together. I think it's a gripping story. Makes you wonder what's going to happen next, unless you cheat like I did and leave a few.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I love all these interviews I did so many years back when I didn't even know what I was doing, but they're just, you know, I cherish them. They're incredible. Most of those people were great characters, all of them, a lot of my relatives that worked back then. You know, they were tough, but they had a lot of charm and they were good storytellers. So I just feel very blessed that I was able to capture all that over these years.
Yeah. Now, what's happened to the film version?
The film is out there. It's playing. I'm actually on the 27th of this month. I'm playing the film at the Brooklyn Historical Society and then signing books afterwards. So I'm doing that kind of thing, hopefully around the country. Playing the film, you know, and selling books. The film is also on Netflix. You can buy it on Amazon. So it's available in a number of different ways to purchase or rent.
Well, Lloyd, we thank you. I think America as a whole thanks you for recording this fascinating piece of history.
Yes.
Did you feel special growing up? You noted that you felt awkward when you were taken back.
Right. I don't know if I felt special. I was a little bit shy about the whole thing. How to handle people coming up to me and saying, "Are you related to Nathan's?" Because they knew my last name. So, I mean, I feel proud. I think I feel even more proud for spending all the time talking to people. I think that, you know, that developed over time. I was maybe a little uncomfortable with it in some ways when I was younger.
I think it's such an enjoyable story, and it's one that touches us right, you know, when we get the spirit coming to the 4th of July. It's that kind of spirit.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. So yeah, thank you so much for writing it and for filming it and for talking to us about it.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me to talk to you, and I appreciate that.
Great meeting you, Lloyd. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Thanks so much, all right?
So there you have it, listeners. That's a wrap for one more week. We hope we'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. And until then,
bye-bye.